There was an impatient, humming excitement that seemed to embrace the entire workings. The urgent shouted commands between pit and roadway, the squeal of rope sheaves, the thudding jar of pick and swinging shovel, the rich lilting chorus of a gang of Basutu tribesmen singing as they worked, small, wiry little mountaineers from the Dragon Range. The white diggers, bullying and bustling, scrambled down the swaying ladder works or stood over their gangs on the pit floor, hawk-eyed, to forestall a pickup. The possibility of a valuable diamond being exposed by a spade and swiftly palmed by one of the black workers to be slipped into the mouth or other body opening at the first opportunity. Illegal diamond selling and buying was already the plague of the diggers. In their eyes, every black man was a suspect. Only men with less than one quarter black blood were allowed to hold and work claims. This law made it easier to apportion blame, for a black face with a diamond in his possession was guilty without appeal. However, this law could not control the shady white men that hung around the diggings, ostensibly travelling salesmen, actors or proprietors of infamous drinking canteens, but in reality all IDB, illegal diamond buyers. The diggers hated them with a ferocity that sometimes boiled over in a night of rioting and beating and burning, in which innocent merchants, as well as the guilty, lost all their possessions in the flames, while the mob of diggers danced about the burning shacks, chanting, IDB! IDB! Zuger moved cautiously out along the crest of the roadway, at times pushed perilously close to the edge by a passing cart laden with diamondiferous earth. He reached the point above Jock Danby's claims, from which he had spoken to the friendly digger the previous day. The two claims were deserted, the leather bucket and rope coils abandoned, a pick handle standing upright with its point driven into the earth far below the level of the roadway. There was a big bearded digger working the adjoining claim, and he scowled up in response to Zuger's hail.
What do you want?
I'm looking for Jock Danby.
Well, you're looking in the wrong place.
The man turned and aimed a kick at the nearest labourer. Sebenza, you black monkey! Where will I find him?
Other side of Market Square, behind the Lord Nelson,
the man answered offhandedly, without turning his head. The dusty, pitted open square was as littered with filth as the rest of the settlement, and crowded with the wagons of the transport riders and the carts of farmers who had come in to sell milk or produce, and of the water sellers peddling the precious stuff by the bucket. The Lord Nelson was stained red dusty canvas over a wooden frame. Three of the previous night's drinkers were laid out like embalmed corpses in the narrow alley beside the canteen, while the single barroom was already filling with the early morning customers. A pariah dog sniffed the breath of one of the unconscious drunks and recoiled with shock before slinking away to raid the open drum that served as a rubbish bin behind the shack. Zuger stepped over the sprawling bodies and gingerly made his way into the noisome slum beyond. He had to make half a dozen further inquiries until he found Jack Danby's hut. So obsessed were the diggers with their own race for the hidden glitter of wealth, and so transient the population of the diggings, that a man seemed to know only the names of his immediate neighbours. It was a community of strangers, every man caring only for himself, completely uninterested in the other human beings about him, except inasmuch as they could either hinder or help him in his quest for the bright stones. Danby's hut was hardly distinguishable from a thousand others. Two rooms built of adobe bricks and covered with thatch and tattered canvas. There was a lean-to at one end, with a smoking cooking fire on which stood a sooty black three-legged pot. In the cluttered, dusty yard stood the inevitable diamond sorting table, a low structure with sturdy wooden legs, the top covered with a sheet of flat iron, which was scoured shiny bright by the diamondiferous pebbles that had brushed over the surface. The wooden scrapers lay abandoned on the tabletop, and a heap of sieved and washed gravel formed a glittering pyramid in the centre of the table. A two-wheeled cart stood in front of the main door of the hut, two somnolent donkeys still in the traces, flicking their ears at the swarming black cloud of flies. The cart was piled with lumps of yellow earth, but the yard was deserted. Incongruously, there were a few straggling scarlet geraniums growing in galvanized 1-gallon syrup cans on each side of the doorway. There were also dainty lace curtains in the single window, so freshly washed that they had not yet turned ochre red with dust, nor become speckled with the excrement of the swarming flies. The touch of a woman was unmistakable, and to confirm Zuga's guess, there was the faint but harrowing sound of a woman weeping from the open doorway. As Zuga hesitated in the yard, disconcerted by the sounds of grief, a brawny figure filled the doorway and stood blinking in the sunlight, shading his eyes with a gnarled and dirt-ingrained hand. "Who are you?" Jock Danby demanded with unnecessary roughness. "I spoke to you yesterday," Zuga explained. "Up at the pit." "Well, what do you want?" the digger demanded, showing no sign of recognition, his features screwed up in an expression of truculence, and something else, some other emotion which Zuga did not immediately recognize. "You spoke of selling your briefies," Zuga reminded him. Jock Danby's face seemed to swell and turn dark, ugly red. The veins and cords stood out in his throat as he ducked his head down on the thickly muscled shoulders. "You filthy bloody vulture," he choked. And he came out into the sunlight with the heavy, irresistible, crabbing rush of a gut-shot buffalo bull. He was taller than Zuga by a head, 10 years younger and 50 pounds heavier. Taken completely by surprise, Zuga was a hundredth part of a second late in ducking and spinning away from the man's charge. A fist like a cannonball smashed into his shoulder, a glancing blow, but with the force to send Zuga reeling to sprawl on his back across the sorting table, scattering diamondiferous gravel across the dusty yard. Jock Danby charged again, his swollen face working, his eyes mad, his thick, stained fingers hooked as they reached for Zuga's throat. Zuga jackknifed his legs, drawing himself into a ball, tense as the arch in an adder's neck at the moment before it strikes, and he drove the heels of his boots into the man's chest. The breath whistled out of Jock Danby's throat, and he stopped in mid-charge, as though hit in the chest with a double charge of buckshot. His head and arms snapped forward, nerveless as a straw man, and he flew backwards, crashing into the unbaked brick wall of the hut and beginning to slide down onto his knees. Zuga bounded off the tabletop. His left arm was numb to the fingertips from the unexpected blow, but he was light on his feet as a dancer, and the quick rush of cold anger armed and strengthened him. He closed the gap between them with two swift strides and hooked Jock Danby high in the side of his head just above and in front of his ear. The shock of the punch jarred his own teeth, but sent the man spinning along the wall to slump on his knees in the red dust. Jock Danby was stunned, and his eyes were glazing over. But Zuga jerked him to his feet and propped him against the side of the cart, setting him up carefully for the next punch. His anger and outrage driving him on to revenge that unprovoked and senseless attack, Zuga shifted his weight, holding Jock Danby steady with his left hand and pulling back the right fist for a full-blooded swing. Then he froze. He never threw the punch. Instead, he stared incredulously. Jock Danby was blubbering like a child, his heavy shoulders shaking uncontrollably, tears greasing down the sun-raddled cheeks into the dusty beard. It was somehow shocking and embarrassing to see a man like this weep, and Zuga felt his anger swiftly extinguished. He dropped his fist and unclenched it at his side. "Christ!" Jock Danby choked hoarsely. "What kind of man are you to try and make a profit of another man's grief?" Zuga stared at him, unable to answer the accusation. "You must have smelt it, like a hyena or a fat bloody vulture." "I came to make you a fair offer, that's all," Zuga replied stiffly. He took the handkerchief from his jacket pocket and handed it to Jock Danby. "Wipe your face, man," he ordered gruffly. Jock smeared his tears and then studied the stained linen. "You didn't know then?" he whispered. "You didn't know about the boy?" He looked up and studied Zuga's face sharply, and seeing his answer, he handed back the handkerchief and shook his head like a spaniel shaking off the water from its ears, trying to steady his reeling senses.
"I'm sorry," he grunted. "I thought somehow you had learned about the boy and come to buy me out."
"I don't understand," Zuga told him, and Jock Danby started for the door of the shack.
"Come,"
he said, and led Zuga through the hot, stuffy little front room. The chairs, covered with dark green velvet, were too bulky for the size of the room, and the family treasures, Bible and faded ancestral photographs, cheap cutlery, and a porcelain dish commemorating the Queen's wedding to Prince Albert, were on display upon the central table. In the door of the back room, Zuga paused and felt a sickening little lurch in the pit of his stomach. A woman knelt beside the bed. She had a shawl spread over head and shoulders. Her hands clasped before her face were roughened and reddened by the drudgery of labour over the diamond sorting table. She lifted her head and looked at Zuga in the doorway. She might once have been a pretty girl, but the sun had coarsened her skin, and her eyes were swollen and reddened with grief. The wisps of hair that hung lankly from under the shawl were greasy and prematurely greyed. After that one glance, she lowered her head again, and her lips moved silently as she prayed. A child lay upon the bed, a boy no older than Jordan. His eyes were closed, his features very pale, bloodless as candle wax, but infinitely peaceful. He was dressed in a clean nightshirt, his limbs neatly arranged, the hands folded on his chest. It took Zuga a full minute to realize that he was dead.
"The fever," whispered Jock at Zuga's side.
He broke off and stood dumb and massive as an ox, awaiting the butcher's stroke. Zuga took Jock Danby's cart down to Market Square and purchased a dozen rough-sawn planks of lumber, paying the transport rider's price without haggling. In the dusty yard in front of Danby's shack, he stripped to his shirt sleeves and planed the raw planks, while Jock sawed and shaped them. They worked in silence, except for the wicker of plane and saw. The rough coffin was ready before noon, but as Jock lifted his son's body into it, Zuga caught the first whiff of corruption. It happens very swiftly in the African heat. Jock's wife rode on the battered cart with the coffin, and Zuga walked beside Jock Danby. The fever was ravaging the camp. There were two other carts already at the burial ground, a mile beyond the last tents on the Transvaal Road, each surrounded with a silent knot of mourners. And there were graves ready dug, and a grave digger to demand his guinea. On the way back from the burial ground, Zuga stopped the cart in front of one of the canteens that fronted the market square, and with the remaining coins in his pocket, he bought three bottles of Cape brandy. He and Jock sat facing each other on the overstuffed green velvet chairs, with an open bottle and two tumblers on the table between them. The tumblers were embossed with cherry gold letters. "The Queen, God bless her." Zuga half-filled the tumblers and pushed one across to Jock. The big man studied the contents of the tumbler, holding it in his huge fists between his knees, hunching his shoulders and drooping his head.
"It was so quick," he muttered. "Yesterday evening he ran to meet the cart and rode home on my shoulder."
He took a swallow of the dark liquor and shuddered. His voice was husky as he went on.
"He was so light. No meat on his little bones." They drank in unison. "There was a jinx on me from the moment I drove my first peg on those bloody claims." Jock shook his great shaggy head. "I should have stayed on the river diggings like Alice told me."
Outside the single lace-covered window, the sun was already setting, a lurid red show through the dust clouds, and as the gloom gathered in the room, Alice Danby came through and placed a smoky hurricane lantern on the table between them, and followed it with two bowls of boer meal porridge, swimming in a thin and oily mutton stew. Then she disappeared silently into the back room, and from time to time during the long night, Zuga heard her gentle sobs through the thin dividing wall. In the dawn, Jock Danby lolled in the green velvet armchair, his shirt open to the navel, and his hairy stomach bulging out of it. The third bottle was half empty.
"You're a gentleman," Jock slurred unevenly. "I don't mean a swell or a toff, but a bloody gentleman, that's what you are."
Zuga sat upright, grave and attentive. Except for a slight reddening of his eyes, he seemed totally unaffected by the night's drinking.
"I wouldn't want to wish the devil's own on a gentleman like you,"
Zuga said quietly. "If you're going, you have to sell to someone."
"They're jinxed, those two claims," mumbled Jock. "They've killed 5 men already. They've broken me. They've given me the worst year of my life. I've seen men on each side of me pull big stones. I've seen them become rich. While me..."
He made a drunken gesture that encompassed the sordid little shack.
"Look at me!"
The canvas that screened the connecting doorway was jerked aside, and Alice Danby stood bareheaded beside her husband. It was evident by her drawn grey features that she had not slept either.
"Sell them," she said. "I cannot stay here another day. Sell them, sell everything. Let's go, Jock. Let's get away from this dreadful place. I cannot bear to spend another night here."
The mining commissioner was a dour little magistrate appointed by President Brandt of the fledgling Boer Free State, who laid claim to the diggings. Brandt was not the only one to have done so. Old Waterboer, the chief of the Griqua bastards, made cross-claim to the arid plains where his people had lived for 50 years and more. In London, Lord Kimberley, Secretary of State for the Colonies, had only just awakened to the potential wealth of the diamond diggings, and for the first time was listening attentively to the pleas of the imperialists to support old Nicholas Waterboer's claim and take Griqualand into the sphere of British influence. In the meantime, the Free State Mining Commissioner was trying, with only qualified success, to maintain some order over the unruly diggers. Just as his roadways were crumbling into the surrounding pits of Colesberg Kopje, so his authority was eroding before the onrush of events with the gathering of national interests and the emergence from obscurity of the first powerful figures as the financial aristocracy of the fields. Zuga and Jock Danby found the commissioner bewailing his task over a liquid breakfast in the bar of the London Hotel, and supporting him by each elbow, they escorted him back across Market Square to his office. By mid-morning that day, the commissioner had copied the details of the Devil's Own claims numbers 141 and 142, held under perpetual quit-rent letter from J.A. Danby, Esquire, to Major M.Z. Ballantyne, and noted payment in full in the sum of £2,000 by cheque drawn on the Standard Bank. An hour after noon, Zuga stood at the corner of Market Square and watched the cart piled high with the green velvet armchairs and the brass bedstead pull away towards the northern corner of the square. Jock Danby led the team, and his wife sat thin and erect upon the load. Neither of them looked back at Zuga, and the moment they disappeared into the maze of narrow alleyways and shanties, Zuga turned towards the kopje. Despite the night of sleep that he had missed, he felt no fatigue, and his step was so light that he almost ran out along the narrow causeway that intersected the jumble of claims and workings. The Devil's Own were deserted, 2 forlorn patches of raw yellow earth, neatly squared off and littered with abandoned equipment. Jock Danby's black workers had gone, for there was always a desperate shortage of labourers on the diggings. When Jock had not mustered them the previous dawn, they had simply wandered away to take daily hire with one of the other diggers. Most of the mining gear left on the claims seemed worn out, the buckets on the point of bursting, and the ropes furry as fat yellow caterpillars. Zuga would not trust them with his own weight. Gingerly he climbed down the swaying ladder, his cautious movements alerting the diggers on the neighbouring claims that he was an outsider.
"Those are Jock Danby's briefies, man," one of them shouted a challenge. "You're breaking the diggers' law. That's private ground. You better clear out, and bloody quick at that."
"I bought Jock out," Zuga shouted back. "He left town an hour ago."
How do I know that? Why didn't you go up to the commissioner's office? Zuger asked.
The challenger scowled up at him uncertainly. The level of his claim 20 feet below the Devil's Own.